Medical professionals. What is a shady practice that you witnessed in the medical field that is a huge problem if surfaced? Story 1. Worked for a private ambulance service that would still run high-priority calls out of hospitals if the sending hospital couldn't provide service, either due to no personnel or equipment, or nursing home/care facilities that preferred not to rely heavily on emergency services. Dispatch would frequently miscommunicate about our ETAs to facilities. Say, one of our units was 40 minutes away. Hospital would call us, dispatch would say 20 minutes. That way the hospital wouldn't call another service that might be closer. And by the time the sending hospital realized we weren't there in the time quoted, it would be too late/silly to call another service. In other words, urgent care was sometimes postponed to make a set number of calls since calls meant revenue. Story 2. Medic here. I agree with this. I can't stand my coworkers who brag about getting the rainbow every shift, meaning every gauge of 4, even in patients that clearly don't require a 14G, 16G. I can understand some 18s in those that are severely dehydrated or intoxicated and need the fluids, but anything short of a massive trauma or CPR is unnecessary. And yet, they brag. It's upsetting. Or they'll ask what the patient's favorite color is and hit them with that. Grandma didn't need anything more than a simple 20G. She didn't need that unnecessarily painful 16G in her hand. As for the therapeutic weights, I myself have dropped more people off in the waiting room than I care to count, but it's because their condition didn't justify an ambulance ride. I thought that I'd be seen faster if I came by ambulance. Why am I sitting in the waiting room? Because the active stroke patient needed the bed more so than you, mister. I felt too dizzy to go and called 911 at 3 a.m. because now I have headache, but my vitals are perfect. Half the time, I play very expensive taxi, and it's the verbally aggressive patient that honestly needs to sit down and relax before being seen. I can't blame the nurses and doctors that need to make triage decisions, and it doesn't help that the stubbed toe person has a massive attitude and is terribly entitled. I have to remind myself daily that it isn't my emergency. It is theirs. I am here to respond to their call and deal with it appropriately. They felt it necessary to call 911. Now I am here. What can I do to help? But sometimes people just really push your limits and test you. I haven't personally seen 3 and 4 happen, but I definitely don't disagree. Story 3. I posted about this before, but I ended up in an emergency room due to a medication interaction. I couldn't walk, could barely speak, and was experiencing hallucinations. I don't remember this, but my husband has filled me in. The ambulance took me to a Catholic hospital. They asked him my religion. He said atheist. It all went downhill. He showed them my medic alert bracelet and brought all my meds. He told them I have bipolar disorder, among other things. They insisted I had purposely taken too much. They left me in restraints for hours, and then a doctor said I was fine and could go home. No tests or anything. My husband pointed out I could not walk or complete a sentence. They wanted to give me Haldol. He said that maybe they should find out what was wrong with me first before adding something else. Ultimately, it turned out my lithium was almost at a dangerously high level, but they had waited so long that normal methods of removing it from my body were ineffective. I have lasting effects. Other serious incidents went down too, but that's the basic gist of it. Story 4. The needle gauge thing is the worst I've seen that didn't involve poor care for folks with mental illness. And I've seen it many times, all in ERs. It's messed up. Of course, often the patients who it happens to either are mentally ill or have issues related to substance problems that cause them to be difficult or are just very unpleasant individuals. The latter, it's still quite wrong, but I have no empathy for the former too, though, especially for mentally ill folks. I find it disgusting. This is something I've seen primarily with ER nurses. I've been lucky to work in places with pretty great emergency psych care, but even there I've seen the ER folks, rather than the psych folks, be completely cruel to psych patients before they get transferred to the proper side. It's upsetting. Story 5. Refusal to do things differently because of prior training or poor advice. Tons of doctors I would see, I used to be a medical rep, will be using extremely outdated methods or tech or refuse to acknowledge the usefulness of new things simply because they went to med school and learned it a certain way. And that's not just me as a sales guy talking. There were doctors who legitimately wouldn't do tests for things, even if it was no extra cost to them or the patient, just because it came along later in their career after they were already comfortable with their approach. Story 6. Work for a medical professional. We are seeing a concerning practice really coming to light on social media, and people are eating it up. At-home DIY orthodontics. That's right. People are literally treating themselves with invisible aligners like Invisalign. Only you take your own molds, mail them in, and voila, treatment. Here's the problem. Yes, it's a cheaper alternative, and yes, it is heavily marketed on social media and online in general. However, when you go to see a doctor or a specialist like an orthodontist, you're paying for what they know, years of experience and education you didn't have to go through. People are experiencing tooth loss, ending treatment with open bites, ending with spacing or crowding in spots that didn't have it before, all because they wanted to save some money and do it at home. And yes, these problems can cause periodontal issues if they are not treated. The issue is the companies doing these aligners claim that you have a dentist, not even a specialist, overseeing your case. Except, you don't. You aren't allowed to go to the dentist listed on your box because guess what? You aren't their patient. And when you call asking for a tax ID number so you can file your insurance, yeah, no, you're not going to get that either. Why? Because then they'd have to claim responsibility for you as a patient and put themselves in a position to potentially be held legally accountable by someone they haven't even seen in person. So why are they signing off on cases so people can receive these aligners via mail? They get paid by these companies to do so. People just don't get it. We have patients who have tried this come in and wonder why their bite is worse than where it started or why they have major overjet now. Well, it was just meant to fix one tooth. It's never one tooth, folks. Your whole mouth is involved when teeth start moving, which is why x-rays are important. So if there's a short root, we know before putting you in treatment because the possibility of losing it during treatment is there. Or if there are other issues that need to be addressed, we can fix those before putting you in Invisalign or braces. Orthodontics should be treated like any other medical or dental procedure. If you wouldn't give yourself a root canal or perform surgery on yourself, don't try to move your teeth on your own. See a professional, and if you decide to take the DIY route, make sure you put some money aside for the orthodontist you'll be seeing later to fix the open bite you didn't have to begin with. Story 7. I don't have anything too bad, but I was working visitation at a nursing home where they didn't have a policy to count medication. If you know anything about nursing homes, it's that you either have really trustworthy nurses or nurses that just get rotated a lot, mostly due to missing medication issues. Story 8. We've seen both sides of the coin with my wife. First son. We went to a local hospital and had to be induced. We had a giant delivery room. Everything was wonderful. They treated us and our son perfectly. They checked in on us every couple hours to make sure everything was good, walked my wife to the curb, etc. Second son. Let me preface this by saying my wife gave birth in our home as an emergency situation. The hospital we went to was very inattentive to her needs. As soon as she arrived and they took the baby away to monitor him a little, they had her take a shower by herself. She fell, hit her head, and cut her foot. This was even after she had mentioned feeling lightheaded. When we were in our room, we always had to call them to help us rather than them checking in on us. They were often very late to bring supplies, and it was frustrating. My second son had jaundice and needed the UV lights. They made my wife do the whole procedure and monitoring by herself. It was already stressful enough. Then they made her stay an extra 2 days to monitor her own baby under the lights. When it was time to leave, they just said, "Okay, take care," and that was it. When I saw the charge for nursery, and it was nearly $2,000, I almost lost it and considered mailing them my frustration in written form. Story 9. I work in a hospital. I'm aware of a case where someone's medical information was accidentally copied then pasted into the wrong patient's file. This resulted in the wrong patient undergoing neck surgery they did not need. The correct patient actually had thyroid cancer and had their treatment delayed. Legal action followed. TLDR, don't copy and paste when it comes to medical information, or at least pay very close attention. Story 10. I kid you not. I used to work as an EMT, and I responded to a call for a patient who was experiencing serious respiratory issues. We got on scene and found out that our patient was an elderly man who had recently been taken off of hospice care because his expected mortality became less apparent, so he was placed back in nursing home care. Because of his fragile state, one of his family members, I forget which one, signed a DNR/DNI form on his behalf that's a do not resuscitate/do not intubate, which essentially means don't perform basic emergency medical interventions on this patient, even if he declines rapidly.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
There are a lot of other things a person can check off on the form, like do not transport to hospital, etc. Anyway, when we found this out, we had to tell the nurse that legally we couldn't treat this man nor transport him because his DNR had the do not transport box filled in. She didn't like that one bit, so she asked for it back so she could dispose of it. Huge inno-inno. We made a copy, took it with us, and told her that we weren't taking this guy at all. 30 minutes later, we hear of another crew that transported the guy because there was no documentation contraindicating the process. We ended up faxing a copy of the DNR to our shift command, and I'm pretty sure the nurse was let go after that. TLDR, a nurse got caught trying to destroy legally binding paperwork so her patient could go to the hospital, despite the fact that the paperwork specifically stated to not do that. Story 11. Time limits on labor. They're not always medically necessary in most cases. Failure to progress is generally failure to allow labor to start on its own and inducing before it is actually time to do so, and are augmenting with the expectation that a woman will deliver within X hours. Cesareans are highly overused. Also, I encourage anyone interested to research nuchal cords. They are often used as a convenient explanation for D-cells and infant heart rate, failure to progress, stillbirth, etc. Yet many modern research studies show that this is not the case. Story 12. We interfere so much with labor progress. It's overwhelming. If we just let women get on with it instead of trying to control everything, we would have higher rates of natural birth. Failure to progress is the bane of my life. If I could ban one phrase at work, it would be this. It's so disheartening and makes the woman feel like she failed at giving birth. It is different if the baby's heartbeat is not reassuring, but so often women are going to theater because of the time limits we set for them. I always feel like we have to strictly adhere to the guidelines instead of working in a woman-centered way. It's all defensive practice. An induction of labor, I could and have gone on about this for hours. In my area, they brought forward the induction dates by a week for women who have gone past term. This is to reduce stillbirth rates, but there really is no strong evidence to suggest it will make a difference. So more and more women are being induced, which just introduces a whole load more challenges. I always describe interventions as a snowball effect. Once you have one, it often leads to another, which leads to another, and before you know it, the woman is in theater for a surgical delivery or assisted birth. Obviously, not trying to say every woman who is induced won't have a natural birth, but it becomes less likely. I had a placement at a low-risk midwife-led unit, and since they brought forward the induction dates for women, their natural birth rates have declined rapidly because more people are having a medicalized birth. I also just worked in a low-risk unit close to an obstetric unit. When first-time mothers come in, I won't always even do a vaginal examination unless they look like they're in established labor. I'll just send them for a walk or to go home until contractions are more regular, because once you commit them to being in labor, the clock starts ticking. And first labors can take a long time, which I don't think people realize. Anyway, rant over, sorry if this is awful grammar. I just woke up from finishing a string of night shifts. I just feel really passionate about promoting natural birth. But with all the interference, I feel like I'm fighting a losing battle. Story 13. My county hospital, which is a teaching hospital, engages in a practice called overlapping surgery. A lot of hospitals do this, but patients don't know about it. They do two surgeries at the same time because the attendings part of the surgery is very short, so the surgery residents slash fellows do all the other parts under their direction, but the attending won't necessarily be supervising directly or even be in a room. That way, the senior surgeon can be listed on billing for multiple procedures while only actively participating in one or two. It happens at a lot of hospitals, but you're never told about it. And that's my issue with it. The patients aren't informed. At least at my hospital, they aren't. If you were told that your surgeon would be performing one or two other procedures at the same time as yours, would you still sign off on it? I probably wouldn't. Story 14. First and foremost, the ridiculous cost of literally everything in the medical field. A lot of precise equipment is justifiable, i.e. artificial heart valves made by hand in sterile clean rooms, cardiac stent, etc. But a screw for $10,000 is insane. Computer processors are manufactured from beginning to end in clean rooms as well, and probably under more exacting specs. Medical equipment can be manufactured and then cleaned and sterilized with gas, UV, or radiation. Most everything is manufactured for single use for infection prevention and fear of cross-contamination. So the volume of waste is just obscene. Plus, much of the garbage is classified as biological waste, so getting things recycled is difficult. There are personnel shortages because hospital staff are tired of dealing with difficult situations. I was in critical care and almost quit nursing because most nights I was a glorified waiter who was poorly treated. We are held to customer satisfaction scores no matter what. Whether your complaint is valid, or if you're a patient with substance use disorder on your 10th admission for the month, and we didn't push the pain medication quickly enough to meet your expectation. Story 15. Last year, anesthesia resident here. Seen a lot of questionable things, but this one was the worst. In my first year of residency, I was on call during the night with my supervisor, an anesthesiologist, who had a really bad reputation, and I didn't know why or the details of it. After starting a surgery at 2 a.m., he just left and I didn't hear from him for the rest of the case. I finished and woke up the patient. After that, I counted the sufentanil we used, a medication 1000x as potent as morphine, and we were missing a lot, we were way off balance. I searched for my supervisor everywhere to tell him, only to find him heavily impaired on a chair near the on-call bedrooms. I now understood where his bad reputation came from, and he went to rehab a few months later. It's pretty concerning because we represent less than 1% of doctors, but represent 15% of doctors with substance-related issues in Canada at least. The incredibly easy access to medications like narcotics and ketamine is probably the number one factor. Story 16. I've seen it plenty of times in a general government hospital that generally treats low-income individuals here in Mexico, where I used to work. Usually, since it's a government hospital, it gets overcrowded with hospitalized patients. There have been times when it was so crowded, we would need to use the floor to lay people down. And usually, we would get a John Doe or a Jane Doe every once in a while, mostly individuals who were injured while under the influence, and they would be intubated and unconscious for weeks and even months at times. When we got a patient who was considered higher priority, someone with a known name, age, date of birth, and family members who needed a bed but all of them were occupied, one of the head physicians would say, well, just disconnect the John slash Jane Doe. And they proceed, even though end-of-life procedures like that are not legal in Mexico. The nurses or interns would go right up, disconnect John slash Jane Doe, extubate him or her, and write down cardiac failure as the cause of death. Their justification was always something along the lines of, well, it's just another person without support who was injured while impaired. No one is going to miss them. Never in my life have I seen such disregard for human life, even if it's someone who is often seen as a burden to society. I'm glad I don't work in that hospital anymore. Edit, clarification. This was mostly done in the ER. It was less common in other hospital departments. Story 17. There was a big controversy at Mass General, consistently one of the highest-rated hospitals in the U.S., a while back about simultaneous surgeries. Let's say you needed a surgical procedure that should require being under general anesthesia for an hour. The hospital might instead keep you under for 2 to 3 hours, while the surgeon operating on you rotated back and forth between you and several other patients also undergoing surgery. General anesthesia always comes with a certain amount of inherent risk, and that risk is increased the longer a person is kept unconscious. Even more concerning, the hospital was not informing patients that they would be sharing a surgeon and therefore staying under longer than medically necessary. The hospital claimed that this was the best way to make use of their most highly trained surgeons, and there is some truth to that, but it feels really questionable not to tell patients about it. They could easily have given people an option: take a 4-hour surgery with a top surgeon, or a 2-hour surgery with a very competent but more junior surgeon, and inform them of the risks involved in choosing the longer procedure. Story 18. As a pharmacist, there are a few pain clinics that send in prescriptions for heavy-duty pain medications. For high doses or long-term use, we have to have a diagnosis code to fill. There are a few that refuse to give that information to the pharmacy as well as the patient. With the ongoing opioid crisis, there are these clinics that prescribe medications without a verifiable reason. If they don't give the codes to a patient or pharmacy, they can avoid accountability for potentially inappropriate prescribing. Luckily for my state, that will soon change. The legal requirements will be updated to require proper diagnosis for high-risk levels of opioid use. Story 19. Forcing staff to continue to work with serious contagious illnesses like TB. I worked at one hospital like this. We were short-staffed, and they really didn't seem to care that there was a TB outbreak. They made us come to work anyway, while doing mass amounts of overtime. I ended up quitting because I genuinely felt like my health was at serious risk. Meanwhile, every patient that came through the ER was exposed to staff with active TB. We are supposed to be helping the ill and injured, not putting them at risk. Needless to say, this hospital has been taken to court countless times for issues like this. Story 20. I'm not a medical professional, but my buddy is an EMT and once took a 3-year-old with flu-like symptoms to a local clinic. The doctor there quickly diagnosed him with a minor cold, but my buddy disagreed and said it seemed like he was developing pneumonia. The doctor reprimanded him harshly in front of everyone and embarrassed him. The child's parents took him home, and he later went into severe distress and passed away. Story 21. A certain 3-letter pharmacy chain pushes pharmacists to fill 400-plus prescriptions per shift. So, on average, that is at best 80 seconds to confirm that the little white pill is the correct little white pill, the dose is correct, the directions are correct, and the patient name is correct. All while 30 people are in line, 3 phones are ringing, 5 cars are in the drive-through window, and you are understaffed as usual. It worries me how many mistakes are made and never caught by the pharmacy, or never noticed by the patients. Story 22. A pretty disturbing incident happened in an or at a hospital where my school was doing clinical rotations. A patient was having open heart surgery, and the CRNA used up all of their stock of anesthesia. This was a larger patient who metabolized the medication quickly. The patient regained consciousness in the middle of the surgery. Their chest was open, and they suddenly started making the most unsettling grunting and groaning sounds. All of the medical staff had to hold the patient down as their arms and legs began to move. The surgeon started shouting at the CRNA, who started calling for more medication while the staff tried to keep the patient still and prevent interference with the surgical site. Someone rushed in, and the staff administered more medication to sedate the patient and induce amnesia. What bothers me about the whole event is that this patient will never, ever know that it happened. The records of what occurred in the OR will likely be sealed. That doesn't sound so bad, right? But there are people who have had experiences like this and retain subconscious memories. They may begin to experience nightmares and other psychological challenges without knowing why. The only way to obtain the records of that surgery would be to get a lawyer and force the hospital to release them. And who would go that far based on nothing more than a lingering feeling that something went wrong? Story 23. Your doctors aren't necessarily telling you the whole story. I'm a post-op surgical nurse, and a few times, 2-3x, I've been told in report that the doctor accidentally caused minor internal damage during the procedure, and while they fixed it up right away, we should be watching for complications in case it doesn't hold. The patients weren't told this. Also, not unethical, but I think people would be surprised to realize how much influence nurses have on their care. Story 24. This happened to my 82-year-old dad. He had his bladder removed, and within a few days, he had a burst intestine, we believe due to a surgical complication. A second surgeon performed emergency surgery in the middle of the night to clean up his abdomen, which was full of waste, and repair the intestine. We were told that the odds were poor that my dad would survive the surgery. He did survive, but then developed a fistula, basically a tube of scar tissue leading from his intestine to his skin surface. He passed away after spending 6 months in the hospital fighting infection after infection. Shortly after the fistula developed, the second surgeon said that he must have accidentally caused damage to the intestine during the emergency surgery and that this was the cause of the fistula. We strongly believe that he was not aware of it at the time but simply assumed afterward that it was likely due to that. Regardless, he admitted that he was possibly at fault. We did and still do consider him a hero in this situation because he pulled my dad through a critical moment, continued to coordinate care as best he could afterward, and had the courage to acknowledge a possible error. The first surgeon? Cold and indifferent. He never even came to check on my dad when he was first admitted for severe abdominal pain a few days after the initial surgery. I heard him talking in the hospital hallway the day of my dad's readmission and went out to make him come in and assess. Come on, my dad is your surgical patient. He barely even looked at my dad, mumbled some vague statements, and left. He never came back again in the whole 6 months my dad was hospitalized. If I could have pursued legal action for medical negligence, I would have. Story 25. Worked in a hospital as a tech on night shift. Had a patient who had a trach and was on a vent. He was with us for a while and pretty cool for the most part. One night, he just got super combative and pulled his vent off and wouldn't let us put it back on, so we had to hold him down to do it. When we got it back on, he kept pulling it off, so they decided to restrain him. The poor guy was restrained all night, and there was absolutely no documentation by the higher-ups that he was restrained, even though we had to document how he was doing every 15 minutes or so, and I was specifically told not to mention what happened to anyone. So that's the only really questionable thing that happened. I left not long after that. I also told the tech on day shift that we had to restrain the guy for a bit when he pulled the vent off, despite being told not to share it. I'm not sure what day shift did with that information. I felt bad for that dude. He was cool. So I guess medical professionals not documenting that something happened is deeply concerning. Especially when you had to use restraints. That's extremely unethical. Story 26. Not a healthcare professional. Questionable insurance experience. You buy health insurance and go to a doctor recommended by the insurance plan. His wait time to see patients is 4 to 6 weeks. The cash price for a visit is $65, but through insurance it's $50. The insurance costs you $500 per month. Due to the doctor's limited availability within network, you can only see him once a month. So each visit effectively costs $550 before any additional tests or treatments. Now the doctor wants an MRI. Except the MRI available within network either isn't sized correctly or is unavailable. The MRI ends up with a $1,005 copay out of network, even though the cash price from the same facility is $600 if you qualify as uninsured. You're essentially penalized for having insurance. You're told it's the exact same MRI machine, so the extra charge is just added cost. You return to the doctor 2 months later. By now, you've paid $1,500 in insurance premiums and $1,105 out-of-pocket just for the consultation MRI and a review of the results. The cash price for the same services was $730 and possibly free if you were unemployed. The MRI results lead to a referral to a specialist, but the only ones within network have an 8 to 10 week wait time. Now you're over $2,500 in and still haven't seen anyone who can treat you. The specialist, once available, requires unrelated tests. He's the expert, you trust him. Each test requires 2 visits, one to order, one to review. Each visit is $1,050 plus the cost of testing. If 4 tests are ordered, you're spending more than a year, closer to 13 months, and $6,500 just to get an issue identified. Meanwhile, you're still paying regular living expenses. That specialist refers you to another one who has another wait list and repeats some tests for accuracy. All this time, insurance keeps routing patients to the same offices, increasing wait times, maximizing billing, while care is minimal. You feel like you're part of a cycle that benefits financially without improving health outcomes. 2 years later, out of desperation, you see an out-of-network doctor and pay cash, which is cheaper than out-of-network rates. He solves your issue in 14 days, two visits, and explains the whole process to you. That's when it hits you. You've spent tens of thousands while in pain and unemployed, treated more like a billing opportunity than a patient. Your issue was serious. Your spinal cord was affected, but no one really helped. You file complaints with the insurance company. They're noted. No refunds. No action. You contact the hospital. They say, talk to your insurance. You consult a lawyer, but you're told a bad faith lawsuit would take years, and the payout wouldn't cover legal costs. You haven't paid enough to make it worth pursuing. At this point, after 2 years of being mostly bedridden, your only belongings are a backpack of clothes at your parent house in another state. Your credit is wrecked, your health delayed, and your financial future uncertain, all while the system that failed you continues operating profitably. So now your taxes are covering your health care and much of your debt, while the system that put you there continues as usual. TLDR, health insurance may prioritize billing over care, working with specific offices to keep you in a long, expensive cycle with minimal outcomes. If an injury leads to unemployment, insurance may leave you worse off. Paying out of pocket and dealing with debt later may, in some cases, be the lesser harm. Story 27. I used to work for one of the biggest healthcare systems in the US. The endoscopes were in terrible condition. We knew it too, because I was sent to address the issue. Lack of training and discipline among the workers responsible for sanitizing them, a major problem. These devices can cost as much as an employee's yearly salary, and they were not being handled with care. Some doctors would go through 4 to 5 endoscopes before finding one that was in decent condition to use. Story 28. Unqualified staff. I worked on a behavioral health unit and really noticed it with nurses. Because there's such a nursing shortage, I think some for-profit nursing schools are really pushing people through with only the info they need to pass licensure exams, but with little practical knowledge. While a good nurse can be your best advocate, a poorly trained one can seriously jeopardize patient safety. We had nurses who administered insulin without checking blood sugar, one who gave a large injection directly into a muscle, which can potentially cause serious complications. I've had nurses, I was a tech at the time, who ignored dangerously high or low blood pressures. There was even a travel nurse once who would go into the break room and sleep during most of his shift, leaving the tech alone on the floor to manage emergencies. I've also seen nurses provoke patients with mental health conditions into confrontations just so they could justify administering sedating medication. It's very difficult to remove problematic staff because hospitals often care more about meeting staffing ratios. It simply looks better on paper. Story 29. In Florida, it's starting to surface right now, but being in the mental health and substance use field, I do patient intakes and hear stories all the time, mostly about halfway houses that seem to encourage relapse so they can keep billing a patient's insurance. There are others that partner with certain treatment facilities and get paid to house patients on the side, helping those facilities avoid certain regulations and cut costs. It's a long list of deeply unethical people taking advantage of those who have nowhere else to go. People at one of the lowest points in their lives, finally ready to seek help. Story 30. My husband used to work at an urgent care that hired medical assistants instead of nurses. He once caught one priming in 4-line with the open end sitting inside a sink. He corrected her and told her to throw it out and start again. She was defensive and upset because apparently that was how she had been taught to do it by the other medical assistants. Story 31. I worked on a maternity floor for a bit. When babies are born dependent on substances, they are scored based on a series of symptoms. This score determines if and when the baby can return to the family. The mother was taking Suboxone to manage her condition and was genuinely trying. One of the criteria for scoring is if the baby sneezes multiple times in a short span. The infant sneezed once the whole time the other nurse and I were assessing. She blatantly told me she was going to give him a point for the one sneeze just so the family wouldn't get custody. As a student nurse, there wasn't much I could do or say, but I was appalled. Spoiler, the family got custody and are doing great. Story 32. RN with 7 years of experience here. This isn't a shady practice, but it's terrifying in its own way. The nurse taking care of you or your family member is very likely an inexperienced nurse. When I say inexperienced, I mean a year or less out of nursing school. That isn't so bad in and of itself. We all start somewhere. But the problem is that chances are the majority of the nurses working the floor are just as inexperienced. There have been days I've worked, and it's been me and five new grads. There have been days where the unit didn't have a single experienced RN on board. That's a problem. I'm not criticizing new nurses, but the healthcare environment is so toxic that experienced nurses are moving on. They become educators, managers, administrators, nurse practitioners, anything else. Very few stay on as career nurses. We need experienced floor nurses. Without them, when a new grad has a question, they have no one to fall back on. No one to guide them. No one to say, your patient is about to crash, you need to act now. In turn, that leads to stressed out new grads who get frustrated with floor nursing and leave for other roles, making the original problem even worse. Story 33. A patient had an 8-inch cut on his stomach and received 14 stitches. When it was time to remove them, I watched a nurse use the wrong, non-sterile equipment. Rather than use the proper small blade, he tried to use large scissors and couldn't get them between the stitch and the skin, so he ended up pulling them apart with his fingers to create a gap to cut them. The wound was already weeping, and it could have led to a serious infection. Also, last week a patient's tablets fell out of her mouth onto the floor, and the nurse, instead of getting new tablets, just wiped them off on her top and gave them to her again. Things I will absolutely not be doing once I qualify. Story 34. I'm surprised no enterprising lawyer has challenged this yet. Blatant duty hour violations by residents. ACGME has opened itself up to significant liability by creating a system that often punishes residents for duty hour violations. It's an entirely self-reporting system. Residents go on a website and enter the hours they worked. I would say most just try to estimate it. A large percentage are regularly violating duty hour limits. However, if they were to start accurately reporting those hours, that leads to having to enter explanations for why hours were exceeded, and eventually your program being placed on probation or even losing accreditation. So you could realistically lose your job for reporting your duty hours truthfully. It would be very simple to bring this to light. Start with a malpractice case. Look at every resident involved in the treatment. Subpoena their duty hour logs, and then subpoena their ID badge swipes, parking, doors, etc. Show a consistent pattern of violations and hold accountable the entities that designed and maintained the system, the individual programs, and the ACGME. Story 35. We're supposed to take two separate blood samples at two different times by two different people for group and save, so that if one person makes an error and takes blood from the wrong patient, the second can catch the mistake and prevent the patient from being given blood of the wrong type. Everyone totally just takes two bottles at once and then writes two different times. I raised it once just to watch the person squirm. She gave me some line about, oh, yeah, I just take two, so if one doesn't get tested properly, they have a spare. I'll take another one later. Normally people justify it by saying they don't want to draw blood from the patient twice, but she was clearly making excuses. Story 36. I, as an oral surgeon, once hired an employee to my office who had a phobia of using the same toothbrush twice. I'm unsure of the specific name of the phobia, which I discovered one day when I saw her replacing used, bleached toothbrushes in their wrappers and putting them back in the box to give to kids. When I confronted her, she became very upset and directed me to a website where people with this phobia share experiences. Apparently, it's something of a known phenomenon. Story 37. Hospitalist US doc here. I've seen families talked into hospice for the patient when a second opinion might have changed the outcome. Also, when medical error occurred, the explanation in the chart often reversed or obscured the actual cause, for example. If unnecessary floor fluids eventually overwhelmed a patient with a weak heart and caused sudden lung issues, the documentation might say that a spontaneous heart attack led to fluid backing up into the lungs. Though, to be fair, sometimes that may be a doctor convincing themselves that's how it unfolded. Medical error by doctors and others in hospital settings is estimated by Johns Hopkins research to be the number 3 cause of death in the U.S. It might be even higher if we had data from other healthcare settings. The only type of medical error that has seen real improvement over the past decade is hospital-acquired infections. Most other errors are often overlooked or undocumented. And much like in other professions, there's hesitation in reporting colleagues, which means not much changes. Story 38. Not directly treatment-related, but one thing I often see with non-English-speaking patients is the use of bilingual staff to interpret. Just because someone is bilingual doesn't qualify them to interpret in medical settings. A common excuse I hear is that it takes too long to get someone, or the provider themselves are bilingual so they don't need an interpreter, but that couldn't be further from the truth. I've seen this most with Spanish, since it's the dominant non-English language in the States. Nurses or doctors will pull in cleaning staff to provide post-discharge instructions because they don't want to pick up the phone and call a certified interpreter. So they muddle through it with someone who barely speaks any English themselves. In one case, I heard a bilingual scribe who was pulled and tell the patient to take their Coumadin 3XA day instead of 1XA day, which could have had life-threatening consequences. In another instance, a patient was misdiagnosed because the friend interpreting gave an incorrect description of the symptoms. Stop thinking your 2 years of high school Spanish or casual Spanglish is good enough to talk to patients about complex care. It's doing them a disservice, potentially endangering their health, and exposing your hospital or practice to major liability through avoidable readmissions and treatment errors. Story 39. Former surgical specialty hospital manager here, 12 years at that practice. We had dozens of animals under anesthesia on a daily basis for surgery and radiographs. During that entire period, we did not have a single patient that experienced a fatal complication from anesthesia, including very ill patients. Yes, once in a blue moon, an animal can experience a severe reaction to anesthesia. But it is exceedingly rare if the vet and staff are well-trained in choosing the right anesthetic, administering it properly, and monitoring the patient correctly. Also, taking radiographs with an awake animal means that the technician or assistant has to stand within a foot of the X-ray beam in order to hold the animal still. Even with proper lead protection, we don't want to do that multiple times per day. It's not like you can say, "So, Fido, now you just lay there upside down with your right hind leg flat on the table and your left hind leg over to the side on the X-ray beam. No, just be totally still while I walk over here behind a lead screen and push the button. And now same routine, but now you lay on your stomach with your legs straight out behind you, and be sure to keep that right leg completely straight with a kneecap on the table, even though it hurts." Story 40. Doctors in the workers' comp and auto insurance networks are often aligned with the interests of the insurance companies. The less they find wrong with you, the less the insurance companies have to pay. I've personally known doctors who prescribe a steady supply of pain medication to people who actually need surgery or physical therapy, just to save money for workers' comp. It's troubling, and one of the reasons why there has been a serious pain medication crisis in the U.S. Everyone in the legal field knows about it, but not one single doctor I know has ever faced consequences for it. Edit: one doctor I know received a $20,000 bonus from State Farm for keeping their costs low, while his patients never got the care they needed. That behavior should be fully investigated and held accountable. Story 41. Similar thing used to happen here, except the doctors were aligned with government policy. Where I live, GPs used to receive a bonus from the government at the end of the year if they diagnosed fewer conditions that required long-term treatment. This meant some GPs would ignore clear signs of chronic conditions to avoid losing their bonus. Even referring patients to other professionals could reduce their bonus. The idea was to save money on unnecessary treatments, but it clearly backfired. I personally suffered in two situations because of this. At the age of 13, I woke up one morning with such severe back pain that I couldn't move. My doctor didn't want to refer me for X-rays or other tests because it would impact his bonus. He told me I'd probably pulled a muscle and that since I was nearly an adult, this was just something I'd have to learn to live with. It later turned out I had a serious back condition. My lower spine was straighter than it should be, and I needed pain management and physical therapy every week for the next 3 years. Years later, a different doctor suspected I had fibromyalgia but wouldn't give me an official diagnosis, saying, "There isn't really any treatment for it, so what's the point?" That's actually how I learned about the bonus scheme. A friend's mother, who worked as a nurse at a GP's office, explained it to me. It took me another 7 years to finally get a diagnosis, and I'm now managing my symptoms. Fortunately, the bonus scheme was eventually ended for this very reason. But I still wonder how many people had their conditions ignored for years, just so someone else could keep their bonus. Story 42. Not following the steps in the DSM to diagnose someone. Very few doctors actually refer to it or go through a formal process. At least half the people I know with mental health diagnoses have likely been misdiagnosed. For example, many people believe they have multiple conditions that, according to the DSM, are mutually exclusive. You can't have both depression and bipolar disorder at the same time. When I hear someone say they've been diagnosed with both, I know they've likely been misinformed, and they're now following a path that's unlikely to help them. However, they came to believe that it wasn't the result of the system working the way it was designed to. Story 43. Serious mistakes are sometimes quietly handled. Some time ago, I was consulted on a case in which a foreign object was left in a patient. I didn't even think that was possible anymore, because there are supposed to be multiple layers of safeguards, but it happened. I'll keep the details intentionally vague. At the time, when I was reviewing the patient's past records, I was puzzled to find that there was no record of the original operation in the patient's electronic medical record, EMR. I didn't think much of it in the moment. Months later, I went to look up the case in the EMR, curious how things had turned out. To my surprise, not only was there no record of the second operation, the procedure to remove the object, but my own notes had also vanished. What I suspect happened is that hospital administration instructed the IT team to edit the EMR and remove anything that could raise concerns. I don't know if the patient ever found out, but I have a feeling he did, and that there may have been a confidential legal settlement. Story 44. There's plenty of questionable practice in psychiatry that's well known and largely overlooked. There's still a significant amount of experimental treatment happening that doesn't meet NICE guidelines, but is allowed because the psychiatrist cites a single study where the drug showed success. Psychiatrists often seem to operate without much oversight. I made both formal and informal complaints and have rarely seen anything happen, other than maybe the doctor working elsewhere for a while. I witnessed a doctor threaten to initiate a psychiatric hold on a woman simply because she was asserting her right to leave as an informal patient. She wasn't high risk, just argumentative. I reported it. Nothing happened. Story 45. This will probably get overlooked, but billing for level of care is often exaggerated, especially when it comes to the physical exam and review of systems portion. Honestly, I think a lot of the documentation requirements are excessive and have only increased since the rise of EMRs made it easier for practices to bill higher initially. Now, insurance companies have caught on and require more and more unnecessary documentation and notes just to reimburse at the same rate. So a lot of doctors will document parts of the physical exam or review of systems that they didn't actually perform, just to meet billing requirements and get reimbursed. Story 46. I left my job in a retail pharmacy because the primary focus was on pushing sales, not on patient health. It was disheartening to be a part of, especially since a lot of the clientele was elderly and didn't question what or why they were taking certain medications. When someone was prescribed a pain reliever or an antibiotic to get through an illness, our system would automatically generate a refill request, even when the medication wasn't needed long term. Doctors would see the request and assume the patient asked for it, so they'd approve it. Before long, that medication would become part of the patient's daily routine. They had no idea why they were taking it. They just figured they must need it since their doctor prescribed it. Many times, there were conflicts with other medications or risks from long-term use. For example, ibuprofen can cause serious stomach issues. And if a patient realized they didn't need the refill, we were trained to say things like, "But your doctor prescribed it." You should at least discuss it with them before stopping. You might as well pick up this last one. We've already filled it. The whole experience really changed my perspective. I'm not against modern medicine at all, but now I make it a point to manage my health through diet and exercise as much as possible. I also believe strongly in being proactive about your own care. Never let someone convince you that you need something if they haven't even reviewed your full medical history. Story 47. I work as a CNA taking care of individuals with developmental disabilities in their homes. I strongly advise against sending your loved ones to one of these programs. The staff are extremely overworked, often underqualified, and pay very little. These programs operate in constant gray areas that allow them to avoid taking full responsibility for the well-being of their clients. And at the end of the day, they are businesses. Their primary goal is to generate revenue based on your loved one's condition. Story 48. Not sure if I count, as I do not currently provide direct care for patients. Right now, I work as a scribe side by side with physicians for their entire shift in ERs and small clinics. And wow, have I seen a lot of concerning things. I've seen a physician perform unnecessary procedures on a patient who had lost their pulse an hour prior. Assuming there wasn't already significant brain injury, the quality of life afterwards was devastating for the family, all because the day had been slow and he wanted to increase his billing. He even admitted this to other physicians who questioned his actions. I've seen a few other cases similar to this one, some even more troubling. I hate to say it, but there are definitely a few physicians out there who shouldn't be practicing. Then there's the overly relaxed attitude toward prescribing antibiotics. Not all physicians, but many. While I can understand some of the pressures they face, it's disheartening to see antibiotics given just in case to young individuals who say they've had a 10 out of 10 sore throat for one day, even though they were just on the phone, laughing loudly, right before their visit. I've also seen issues with admitting physicians or hospitalists who refuse to admit patients needing further care. While I understand they're often overwhelmed, it's still their responsibility. This delays treatment, and ED physicians are limited in what they can do while caring for others. I've even seen cardiologists refuse to take STEMI patients, which has led to delayed care that could have otherwise prevented serious complications. Staffing is another huge issue. Some hospitals are simply overwhelmed and understaffed. How can we expect excellent patient care when we don't have enough physicians or nurses to provide it? And dialysis centers. I get that some symptoms during or before treatment might be concerning, but we often receive patients with mild symptoms that could have been handled after dialysis. Instead, they get sent to the ER, miss their treatment, and now actually become sick due to that missed dialysis, and we end up having to admit them. These are just a few examples. I'm not a physician, so I apologize if I don't fully grasp all aspects of these situations. But these are my personal experiences, and I've seen enough to know there's a lot that needs to improve. Story 49. My grandfather is elderly and has health issues, so we've gone through the ambulance to ICU process multiple times. They have good insurance, and often it felt like our grandparents were caught in the middle of a battle between insurance companies and hospitals. The way our insurance works is that after a certain deductible is met, the insurance covers most, if not all, of the hospital costs. So once hospitals know the level of coverage, it sometimes feels like their goal is to maximize billing from the insurance. Like, yes, they stabilized my grandfather when he was having complications from medications interacting, but did they really need to keep him admitted for a full week? All they did was provide 4 fluids, food, and tell us his glucose was high after a meal. Of course, it was, he's diabetic. They billed the insurance company around $4,000 a day, and it probably would have continued if we hadn't pushed for discharge. Story 50. Medical student. I did a rotation at a hospital where my attending, who was a geriatrician, would take the list of patients on the floor and go see the ones over 65. Then, after seeing them, she would go to the residents and tell them to submit a referral before she added her note. There was really no medical need for a referral in most cases, but she'd instruct the residents to submit it anyway, because she was the senior physician on the floor and also the director of the residency program, who had hired those very residents. I haven't seen that happen anywhere else. In all the other specialties I've rotated through, the specialists have always waited for a formal referral from the primary team before going to see a patient, not just scanning charts for something potentially billable. If any hospitalists or physicians reading this have insight or experience with something similar, I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts. Thanks. Story 51. Volunteer first responder here. In the last few years, I've interacted with many types of doctors and researchers. Not too long ago, I met a scientist who studies radiation. He had an injury while I was on duty. We talked for a while, and I learned some very interesting things. You often hear from mainstream sources that the radiation emitted by phones like iPhones or Androids is entirely safe, and that studies confirm there's no cause for concern. Based on what I learned, that's not entirely accurate. I won't go too deep into it, but for your own well-being, please avoid sleeping with your phone under your pillow or wearing it directly against your body all day. Try to place it on a shelf or keep it in a bag whenever possible. It's a small change that might make a big difference. Story 52. I did my internships at a doctor's office where unnecessary testing was often ordered for patients with Medicare or Medicaid, and follow-ups were scheduled more frequently for these patients, which led to overcrowding. The doctor was also much quicker to suggest surgery if the patient had Medicare or Medicaid. Knee pain, surgery was immediately recommended, along with a lot of vague justifications. For example, a patient with basic insurance walked in with a visible bulge that had white discharge. The doctor simply treated it in office, cut it open, and drained it. Another patient with an identical condition walked in, but this time had Medicare. That patient was sent for lab work, an MRI, and even referred to a neurologist, which didn't make much sense, before eventually coming back for the same simple in-office procedure. Story 53. I'm a phlebotomist, and I see coworkers preloading their needles, taking them out of their packages and setting them up, and laying them all out on their carts so they can save time during morning pickup. Extremely unsanitary. Like, how many rooms did they go in and out of before that needle was actually used? I've told my boss, and she already knows about it. I have no idea why nothing has been done. This is exactly why I refuse to let anyone stick me unless I see them open and prepare the needle right in front of me. Story 54. A lot of medical professionals receive only minimal consequences for serious personal violations against patients, ranging from accessing private medical information of non-patients to inappropriate conduct with those in their care. In many parts of Canada, doctors are disciplined by their own regulatory colleges, and often, all they receive is a minor penalty for such accusations. Many end up with restrictions on their license, such as conditions on practice permit. An individual's approved in writing by the college must be present as a chaperone during the examination of any female patient where there is disrobing. Disrobing is defined as the removal of any clothing item except shoes, socks, jackets, or other outerwear. No hospital work except for or assists. No house calls except in exceptional circumstances and only with a chaperone present. Restricted to a maximum of 60 hours per week of practice, on average. This is from the provincial profile of my previous doctor. I had seen him after these limitations were already in place, though I didn't know it at the time, and they were not being followed. He has since been further disciplined based on other people's complaints about noncompliance, but he still practices. I don't think most people realize their doctors may have restrictions or formal conditions placed on their license, and that these aren't always disclosed or properly enforced. Story 55. My mom had a defibrillator implanted about a month ago, and when she was released from the hospital, her doctor prescribed her a pain medication that isn't even manufactured anymore, Percodan. She was in so much pain, but the hospital couldn't get in touch with her doctor, and neither could we for an entire day. No one else could prescribe her anything, because he was the one who performed the surgery. There's more that he's seriously mishandled with her care, and I want her to consider legal action, but she's worried it'll be too hard to prove medical negligence. Story 56. I used to work as a phlebotomist at a plasma donation center, and while I generally support plasma donation, it really can help save lives. There are definitely some concerning practices that people don't talk about enough. For example, I've seen management allow people to donate who clearly appeared impaired. Whether it was from alcohol or something else, it was obvious, and yet they were still allowed to proceed. There are also some outdated rules that centers still follow, not because of current science, but because plasma is shipped internationally and must follow global regulations, even when those rules seem unfair or discriminatory. As for training, it was basically just stick people until you're good at it. Not much oversight, and definitely not the most thorough approach for something involving needles and human health. I'm not saying plasma donation is evil, it does real good, but people deserve to know that not everything behind those doors is as safe or ethical as it should be. Story 57. Not labeling and changing out for tubing. I see a lot of coworkers who will unhook someone who's on like Q6H antibiotics and just drape the tubing over the four-pole and use it for the next infusion. No Kuros cap or anything. And they're obsessed with keeping the line prime for the next dose. I throw out undated lines and nurses get legit upset about it sometimes. It's weird and unsafe. Then they wonder how clab size happened. Story 58. Physician here. And I can't tell you how many doctors and nurses I see that don't do something as simple as wash your hands before and after a patient encounter. No, please see that patient in an isolation room for possible serious respiratory illness and walk out the room while checking your 401k on your iPhone, and then casually tap the colleague on the shoulder because you're likely feeling lonely and risk transmission of illness. Story 59. My friend's mother passed away unexpectedly during a routine gallbladder surgery and had, prior to her passing, had a plan in place to donate several of her organs for scientific study. The hospital sent everything out almost immediately before there was a chance for a post-mortem exam to determine what had really happened. Prevailing thought is that it was an anesthesiology incident that actually led to her passing, but there was no way for the family to prove it. Story 60. Sort of off topic, but I've tattooed multiple nurses that have stuck their fingers right in their freshly tattooed skin when I finished. For those who don't know, that's called cross contact because then they'll put that contaminated finger on a doorknob or their credit card or whatever and get harmful germs all over everything. It's a big deal, and we are all trained not to cross contaminate. So, as nurses, they should know the drill way better than me. but no, touched the tattooed area and had to get a very stern cleanup by me. Now I watch nurses very carefully.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.